The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Bloomberg Intelligence Vanguards of Healthcare podcast series, which features leaders at the forefront of change in the healthcare industry. I'm Mark Engelsjerd, and I'm a biotech analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence, the in-house investment research arm of Bloomberg. I'm very happy to welcome Bob Connelly, CEO of Elicio Therapeutics, to the podcast. Bob joined Elicio in 2018, having previously served as CEO of several other biotech companies, including Axela Health, Demantis, and Pulmatrix. He was also a venture partner at Flagship Pioneering for 5 years, and over the course of his career has raised over $400 million in financing. Thank you for joining us here today, Bob.
Oh, thanks for having me, Mark.
So, Elicio is a cancer immunotherapy company based up in Boston, which recently made the transition to the public markets and also rolled out initial cancer vaccine data focused on KRAS-driven tumors at the major U.S. oncology conference, ASCO, last month in Chicago. So we have a lot going on and many aspects to the story we can discuss today. But maybe just to sort of level set for our listeners, if you could just explain what cancer vaccines are. I think many people are familiar with vaccines in the context of COVID-19 or influenza, but maybe less so in the setting of cancer.
Yeah, that is a great question and something that people often get confused by. It might be better to think of it almost as like a cancer therapeutic vaccine, because the way cancer vaccines are applied today is they're given when someone has cancer. So they're given to treat the cancer and hopefully treat the cancer with a strong immune response and hopefully educate the immune response that if the cancer reappears, that it will be prevented. So that's kind of the classic vaccine element of it are the prevention piece, which comes later, and the immune response piece, which is a critical part of the efficacy. Does that make sense?
That does. That's perfect. And, you know, I think if people have been following this space, they're probably aware that, you know, cancer vaccines as a concept or as a therapeutic modality have, I think it's fair to say, had some ups and downs. I would be curious to hear your take on how the field has progressed, and then, you know, sort of how you see Elicio contributing.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And I mean, it was a challenge that I knew coming in and taking on the CEO position about 5 years ago, that cancer vaccines had once, I don't know, I mean, maybe 10 years ago, been considered just a real exciting breakthrough area that there was, you know, lots of money being poured into. And the results of that were not at all what people had hoped for. There's a number of, you know, Provenge might be one drug that people remember, or one vaccine that people remember pretty quickly because it did make it to the market, but just with much less effect and reach than people had. But there were many other, or people that had expected, but there were many other cancer vaccines that just never made it to the market. And typically, there's probably a good list of reasons why they didn't. But in pretty much every case, there was a common reason, and that is that they just did not pack enough of a immune response punch to have the effects and the durability of effects that they needed. So where we come in is that, well, let me kind of go back to the start here. Our founder, Daryl Irvin, is from the Koch Institute at MIT. And Daryl has spent pretty close to two decades trying to figure this problem out. How do you make better vaccines? How do you get the immune response to be powerful enough to, you know, kill a cancer or prevent an infectious disease, and then treat the immune response to make sure that it never comes back? And Daryl is kind of an unusual breed of cat, because he brings together in his lab material sciences, chemistry, immunology, oncology, infectious disease, which is kind of a unique group of sciences and knowledge to bring into one place. And as they were working on it, they identified that another common part to all of these vaccines, and now even with cell therapies that are being developed, is very little engagement of the lymph nodes. And if you sat and had a presentation from us, you'd hear lymph node over and over and over again. And because the lymph nodes are where the key immune cells, and specifically T cells, are located, it's where they're created. It's where they're differentiated, you know, basically given their orders, told where to go, and told how hard to hit. And it's very difficult. So this is not something that's kind of new, that was a new discovery. It's something that people have known for a long time. It's just very difficult to get any kind of immunogenic payload to the lymph nodes and into the lymph nodes where antigen presenting cells can present them, you know, to T cells. And so a lot of Daryl's work was directed at solving that problem. And he developed a number of different technologies, which we licensed in. So this company was started in 2011 with one of the earlier versions of Daryl's technology for lymph node targeting. And then he brought forward a much more advanced technology, which we call Amphiphile. And you'll hear me refer to it as AMP throughout the technology. But what the Amphiphile technology does is very precisely traffic a range of different types of immunogenic cargos, antigens, nucleic acids, directly to the lymph nodes, very precisely to the lymph nodes where they are taken up by antigen presenting cells, and all the magic that happens in the lymph nodes takes place. One of my chief medical officer refers to the lymph nodes as a schoolhouse for T cells. And particularly as it relates to cancer, if you're going to be able to kill a cancer, you've got to be able to generate T cells, and they have to be potent. There has to be a high magnitude of them. They've got to be functional, and they need to have durability, because you don't want the cancer to come back. So that's where we come in.
Yeah. So it really does sound like it's a platform approach. I mean, we can talk about some of the initial clinical data that were presented at ASCO last month as it relates to KRAS mutant tumors. But is it safe to say this is a platform approach that could be amenable to any number of antigens or tumor subsets?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And not only, you know, what specific antigens, but delivering multiple, like our KRAS program has seven peptides in it. So we hit seven mutations. But even outside of cancer, or inside cancer, we've shown that and published work that combining the AMP platform with cell therapies like CAR-T, TCR-T, can have a very significant impact on their ability to be effective with solid tumors. And Daryl as well as Alessio, has done a lot of work demonstrating this technology in infectious diseases. So if you can get both the strong antibody response you need, but also the T cell response you need, which again carries the memory factor with it, there's absolutely applications outside of cancer. We have to focus, so we're very focused on cancer vaccines, but and the other areas of application of the platform, we hope to be able to and are working with other parties on, and that can be academic parties, it can be other pharmas, other biotechs, etc. Mm-hmm.
And I'm probably grossly oversimplifying, but it sounds, I mean, my understanding is that the ability to target antigens preferentially to the lymph nodes comes from essentially linking them to albumin, which is one of the more common proteins. I mean, if I have that correct, that sounds like a very elegant solution that apparently hasn't been tried before. I mean, is that a fair assessment?
I think, yeah, it's funny because I had the same reaction. What, you know, that boy, this sounds really simple and almost too good to be true. But it took about 10 years to be able to develop that technology where you could hitchhike on the endogenous albumin that is constantly circulating through the lymphatic system and moving from lymph node to lymph node. So the actual development of amphiphile, where you have a a lipid that is designed to preferentially bind to albumin and then has a linker connected to it, which is then connected to the immunogenic payload. And all of that is protected, that payload, the linker, as it moves through the lymphatic system. It's a lot more complex than it sounds, and it took quite a while, you know, for it to be developed, but it is incredibly effective, and it's very widely published how effective it is, both by Daryl's been very prolific in terms of publishing, but we have as well. So it is simple, it's elegant. It also has some major manufacturing advantages, you know, and cost of goods advantages. So these are all things. I'm a non-scientist, though I've spent my whole career in this world, and this was something that was easy for me to understand, having spent most of my time in immunology. But it took a long time to get here. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about your lead program, ELI-002, which is focused on KRAS mutations. And KRAS, you know, is clearly having a moment with some small molecule commercial products from both Amgen and Mirati. And, you know, this has long been considered a quote unquote undruggable target. So what did we learn from the initial clinical data at ASCO, and, you know, just maybe tell us a little bit more about Alessio's vision for the KRAS program.
Yeah, so this is your mention of target of Mirati and Amgen is interesting, because when I started with the company, you know, there was a negative vibe about cancer vaccines, and we wanted to go into KRAS, and everybody thought KRAS was undruggable at that time. And then Amgen and Mirati came forward and showed that it was druggable, which, you know, was great for us to see. What we've taken is the approach, an immune, you know, a vaccine approach to it, and we developed a vaccine that has seven peptides in it. It's designed to address the KRAS mutations that drive 25% of all solid tumors, almost 100% of pancreatic, 50% of colorectal, 25% of lung. I mean, it is really just a nasty, nasty disease. And so what we have shown with in the interim data of our first clinical trial is just a massive response rate. And so we're in patients in the adjuvant stage. So these are patients that were treated with chemotherapy. They were not metastatic when they were, you know, when they were found. They're treated with chemotherapy, they're treated with, and then surgery. So the chemotherapy shrinks the tumor, surgery tries to remove it or get as much of it as they can. But the patients that are in the trial have minimal residual disease. So either through biomarkers or ctDNA, it's clear that the, you know, that the chemo and the surgery didn't get all the cancer out, and that these patients will relapse very, very quickly. In fact, in the case of pancreatic cancer, they'll relapse in an average of 6 to 7 months. Colorectal is a little bit longer, maybe 11 to 12 months. And once they relapse, there's really not a whole lot you can do for them other than observation. Some will go into other experimental trials or take another round of chemo, but chemo is very limited in its effect after, you know, in a second shot at the cancer. So what we showed is really unprecedented data. And I want to highlight that this is as a monotherapy. We did not do this with checkpoint inhibition or with a chemotherapy to follow, which is what typically other vaccines have tried. We were went into pancreatic cancer, which is, you know, as you know, is just a brutal disease. And what we were able to show, so we have 25 patients in the trial. 20% of them are pancreatic cancer. The other 5% are colorectal cancer. And we saw that 77% of the patients responded. And in tumor marker tumor marker reductions, biomarker reductions. And that one third of those patients had a complete response. So their, you know, ctDNA was completely eliminated versus the baseline level we took before they started the vaccine. And the clear driver of that is the T cell response. So 87% of the patients in this trial had a T cell response, and the average fold increased T cell response versus baseline before they were treated with our vaccine is 56 times. So these are really massive increases in T cells. They're clearly having an impact on the tumor. It was shown to be very, very safe. There were no dose-related toxicities. We were able to actually go two cohorts higher than we expected because of what we were seeing on the safety side. And we were able to come out of it with our recommended phase two dose. So that was interim data. It didn't include three patients from the highest cohort. It is a study that will continue to read out markers like relapse-free survival and overall survival, which we'll have more data on in the second half of this year. So that going into the study, my chief scientific officer, chief medical officer, were kind of doing their best to just say, you know, to kind of, you know, I don't know, not dampen my expectations, but to say, you know, what we see in animals isn't always replicated in people, in patients. But this was not only an unprecedented response in the industry, but this exceeded what we had seen in preclinical studies. So this was just, you know, exciting as hell. 87% of these patients see, you know, having T cell responses. You know, you're just not seeing that kind of thing, particularly with a monotherapy.
Yeah, very impressive. And maybe a bit of an unfair question, given, as you just explained, this was the initial human data. But you know, as you reference phase two, and you know, as you think about the path of this program toward a potential marketing approval, you know, sort of what additional questions need to be answered? And then I guess looking further ahead, do you see this being developed for patients with potentially with metastatic disease? Do you envision the potential for using this even earlier? Maybe even as a preventative for certain high-risk patients? What's the potential here?
Well, the preventative is kind of the holy grail, and that is certainly something that we have in our mind. But in terms of short term, there's a number of, we need to get into randomized controlled studies. These are open label studies. We have another study going on now with the expanded version of this, which has more peptide or more mutation coverage. That's the formulation that we'll take forward into the later stage trials. So really there's kind of a couple of key questions here. The durability of the response is a big one. And we're going to see that from the trial that we're in now, but we'll continue to see, or the two trials that we're in now, and we'll see that, you know, we'll continue to report on that throughout this year, and into next year as well. You know, we're going to continue to follow these patients for 2 years. And then we'll look at this also in conjunction with checkpoint inhibition. Now, we were able to generate this data without checkpoint inhibition, and checkpoint inhibition on its own has not been successful in pancreatic cancer. But we've had patients that have come off this study and gone into experimental studies with checkpoint, and they've gone into complete remission. So for us, there's a couple of key questions that we want to answer. Is the broader peptide, 7-peptide approach, which we're testing now in a second trial, is that safe, and is it showing the same kind of responses that we saw with in the first phase one? The durability of the response from both of these trials. And then looking at this, comparing a monotherapy to combining with checkpoint. And then from there, and all that is work that will be done in the next 9 months approximately. And then the goal there is to enter into a phase 2-3 trial. And at that point, we will know whether or not that, how many arms that trial has. Does it have a monotherapy arm and a checkpoint, combination arm. And then, there'll be a control group, it'll be randomized, and we're hoping that it has an opportunity, particularly with kind of a seamless move from phase 2 to 3, to be a registration study. But in the next year, those are the key things. What kind of durability are we seeing of this response in these first couple of trials? And does checkpoint take greater advantage of the type of T cell responses that we're having, and lead to even greater effect in pancreatic and colorectal, which are the two we're really going to focus on in the next year. But I really see us taking the controlled, randomized controlled studies first down the pancreatic path.
Yep, that makes sense. So apart from the KRAS program, I mean, the other big recent milestone at Elicio is that you're now a publicly traded company. I alluded to that earlier. So you executed a reverse merger with Aangeon Biomedica. Love to hear a little bit more about that, what that process was like. I understand anecdotally that can be a fairly competitive process these days.
Right.
How did that go?
Well, let me start with your last statement, because it has really, since the middle of 2021, mm-hmm. We've been in a nuclear winter in the biotech financing world.
Right.
In the last 12 months, there's been maybe 9 IPOs, something like that. And over half of them are probably are trading down from their IPO level. So it's very difficult, both in the private market as well as in to raise money and to go public. We have also a uniqueness about our company in that it hasn't been funded in a traditional way. From the very beginning of the company, it's been funded by very high net worth individuals, higher profile strategic funds and smaller funds. So every other company I've run has had a small syndicate of well-known biotech investors. And that's not what we've had. And then when you throw in the challenges of people still waking up to the potential for vaccine, mm-hmm. Cancer vaccines, fundraising for us this has been probably the hardest company I've had to raise money for, despite the fact that it's the company that has the most potential of any company that I work for. So what we wanted to do with the IPO market really shut down, we wanted to be able to find a way to access public company investors who typically bring more to the table. There's more different ways to get at them, PIPEs, registered directs, confidential, marketed public offerings. There's a lot more ways to raise money as a public company and a lot more people to go to there. And so we looked at a number of reverse mergers, but because of the difficulty in raising money in the private market, which I would argue was harder than in the public market, there's a ton of competition for these mm-hmm. for these reverse mergers. And
right.
I believe in the case of Angion, they had somewhere around 60 bids.
Wow.
So it's a hell of a lot of work on their part.
Yeah.
And they have to narrow that down. I mean, the key people in the company that are running the process have to assess all these companies, typically meet with them at least once, and they start knocking that number down to probably something, in the low teens or even lower, that they get their consultants and their board involved in to hear more about. And then you typically go to a top three. And on those three, you do heavy diligence. This is essentially M&A. So you're doing, really significant diligence. And we, in this case, Angion was represented by Oppenheimer, who we happen to know very, very well. And we had an update with Oppenheimer and shared with them some of the clinical data that we had under confidentiality. And this was actually, after three cohorts, we still had two more cohorts to go. But they were impressed enough by the data and the progress that we made that they said, are you interested in a reverse merger? And yes, we are. And we have a company that is down to really its last four or five. But if you're willing, we could get you in front of them and their board. It may be a little too late, but it's worth a shot. Mm-hmm. And so we said, yeah, let's do it. And that was in, early November. That led to a couple of other meetings that went much deeper, where KOLs were brought in on their side, and they were getting expert consulting. And then we moved to the pole position. And then started both continuing on one side to do really deep diligence, while on the other side, the CEO and I began to negotiate terms. And we got to a term sheet right before Christmas, which is pretty remarkably fast. So it was about a 2-month process from the initial meeting to where we had a term sheet. And then we wanted to try to get the merger agreement out done by a month later, which all the attorneys involved said that these things typically take at least 2 months. We were able to do it mm-hmm. in a month, and then moved on to the S-4, and then all the things involved in that, responding to the SEC, and while internally preparing to be a pubco versus a private company. And so from beginning to end, that's about an 7-month process, which is probably a little bit faster than most of these reverse mergers go. Mm-hmm. But the Angion, I think one of the things that work great here is we've looked at other reverse mergers in the past, but a lot of them have complications to them. They have technology that they want you to advance, or they have a product that they would like to have you dedicate some of the funding to. And we weren't willing to look at any of those. We were just simply looking for a company that recognized the value of what we had, brought cash to the table. So this is, you know, a financing event, and there's $30 million that we were able to get out of it. And that was listed on NASDAQ, and we could bring onto our board people that brought experience that we didn't necessarily have on our board. And Angion was check, check, check. And we worked really well together, and so here we are.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on that transaction. Sounds like it was a lot of work, but ultimately worth it.
Yeah, I think this was, without a doubt, the last 7 months have been, and now I'd actually extend it to these last 2 months, because we're still doing all the transitions. And while we're also out there trying to introduce people to the company, and there was a lot of work leading up to ASCO. And as I mentioned, we have two ongoing trials. So it's been an intense 7-8 years.
Yeah.
So I'm 7-8 months, sorry.
Yeah. Months that seem like years.
Yeah.
So Alicio is based in Boston. And for those of you mm-hmm. that know Boston, I believe specifically in the Seaport area, which
yes.
Didn't used to really exist in its current incarnation. Mm-hmm. I mean, what is that like? What's the sort of mood in the Boston biotech scene these days?
Well, I mean, the Seaport, with our move to the Seaport, has just been great. And for lots of reasons. One is that we really were, Kendall Square, Cambridge, was filling up. You know, I mean, you got all the major pharmas in there now. A lot of the VCs have created incubators there. And we just didn't see a way for us to continue to grow the company. And also, it's expensive. It's expensive to be there. It's expensive to be anywhere in Boston, but Kendall Square is you know, and Cambridge is in particular. So we started looking at other, let's just call them suburbs of Boston versus suburbs of Boston, more so than suburbs of Cambridge, and could see that there were biotech clusters popping up in the Seaport area. There's right now major building going on in Alston, which is right by Harvard, Watertown. And then a lot going on, you know, on the outer rim, outside of Boston. But we looked at the areas that were closer to the city, closer to Cambridge, and really loved the Seaport. And the Seaport is just, you know, there's biotechs popping up all over. I mean, the building we're in is an 8-story building that used to be a complete office building. And I haven't checked recently, but I think it's about 50% biotech now. And, you know, now you see the different types of businesses that support biotechs, like animal facilities, vivariums, are popping up around these different clusters. So it's, Boston, Cambridge, you know, the Boston area is clearly the biotech, you know, capital of the world. When I first got started in this, there's a big, you know, San Francisco was big. The other Cambridge in England was big. In fact, my first company was based there. And there were lots of areas around the country that were trying to create hubs. But Boston has just now become, the Boston area has just become so dominant in the biotech space. Fenway is another area that's grown up.
And very easy access to the airport from the Seaport. That's always a key attribute.
Yep, absolutely.
Maybe just a final question for you, Bob. I always like to ask companies about their name. And I love the name Alicio, but I'd be curious to know if there's a story behind it.
There is. So when I came to the company in 2018, I will tell you that somebody once told me that whenever a CEO takes over an existing company, the first thing they do is change the name. But that is not what was behind this. So when I came in, the company had been around for, I think, about 6 years, and was called Vedantra. And I was very familiar with a more advanced company called Vedanta, that was a microbiome company. And I even had, LinkedIn congratulations for people for taking over as CEO of Vedanta. And sooner or later, Vedanta was going to see Vedantra, and, we were going to get a call or a letter. That's what I assumed.
Right.
And we were also really at that point at a time where we were really committing to Amphiphile. We were really committing to cancer and to KRAS, and as a total focus of the company. So he said, let's find a name that works with that, that we like the way it sounds, that it's memorable. So I happen to have a very close family friend who is the president of the creative group at the Brand Institute. And I think they're probably the most prolific namer of companies. And I think they named several of the COVID vaccines. So I called up Scott and said, "Hey, Scott, I want to change the company name. Here's some thoughts on what we'd like to see. Do you have any time on the weekend to do this?" And he put his whole creative team on it and came back. Initially, they came up with 300, asked us to pull the ones out of it, to try to pull like 30 out of it that we really liked. And they always had the one that they liked the best, but they did, and it was Alessio, but they didn't want to tell us. And so we narrowed it down to, 30, then to 10. And then it was, tell us which ones you like and rank order them. And we had Alessio at the top. And Alessio, as I understand it, comes from Latin with a meaning of to elicit a response. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're all about, to use the lymph nodes to elicit a response. And the fact that it had IO on the end of it, immuno-oncology, was just the icing on the cake. So it was a big assist from the Brand Institute, who now we're working on to name, ELI-002. And that's the story of the name.
I love it. Well, I like the sound of it. And but now that I know the background, I like it even more. Well, listen, Bob, I really enjoyed our conversation today. Wanted to thank you again for being part of Vanguards of Healthcare and sharing your insights about Alessio, the field of cancer vaccines, and the biotech sector in general. And we'll stay tuned, and we'll very much be looking forward to more data from your program.
Countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.